Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why tourism after dark is taking off. And three Arizona college basketball teams are set to enter March Madness today. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
You know, my dad was really, really didn't want us all crying and praying rosaries over him. He really wanted us to do something.
Madam Governor, do you have a phone? Who waits until 19 days before bankruptcy to tell anybody about it?
Stop the politics, stop the games. We can have this supplemental passed right now, today, if we wanted to act.
Searching for who to vote for, party affiliation is an extremely valuable identifier.
I get it. I get that my position is political. What I have been trying to let people know is I think at its core, it's still nonpartisan.
Many federal employees who were illegally fired have been reinstated. More are being reinstated right now as we speak. That is our system of government, checks and balances.
I know that every one of you out there is working hard and parting with your tax dollars. You're expecting it to be used wisely, not misused and mismanaged. And I can tell you that this building is a colossal waste of money.
All this stuff you're hearing every single day is so they can give a big, giant tax cut to people who don't need a tax cut.
And with me to talk about a statewide elected Democrat looking at a potential run for Congress, finger-pointing over budget shortfalls and more, are Chuck Coughlin of High Ground. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Mark.
And former State House Minority Leader Reginald Boulding. Reginald, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Reginald, let me start with you. Adrian Fontes sent out a note this week saying he is, quote, strongly considering a run for Raul Grijalva's congressional seat. Fontes, of course, was Maricopa County Recorder, lives in Phoenix, but is from that part of the state, was born in Nogales, I believe. Is this a surprise that he is taking such a strong look at this?
No, it's not a surprise. I mean, I think the floating, the possibility of running is just out of respect and to, the services for Mr. Grijalva. I mean, I think that there's a 100% chance that he's going to enter the race. I do think that Adelita Grijalva, Raul Grijalva's
daughter,
yeah.
Pima County Supervisor.
Pima County Supervisor. She served on the school board for 20 years there. I could see those two probably being the top two candidates running for that office.
100% chance Fontes gets in, Chuck?
Yeah, good, gone, done, despite other people telling him, why are you doing that? But I think, as Secretary of State, you make 70 grand a year. He's got two kids in high school that he's putting through to college. You know, you win that seat as a Democrat, you're a lifelong congressman. You know, you're making 200 grand plus a year, and it's a tough job. You got to run every 2 years, but it's a Democratic safe seat.
So I'm curious about this because, Reginald, you mentioned Adelita Grijalva, and she was often mentioned as a candidate when her late father said that last year's run would be his last, obviously before he passed away. It seems like a bit of a risk for Fontes, who's, he's up in 2 years for reelection as Secretary of State, but he's leaving a current job for a congressional seat against the daughter of a member of Congress who, just died.
Yeah, I mean, this is very, reminiscent of what happened in Phoenix when, Ed Pastore passed. There's conversations about whether or not Laura Pastore would run. All of the polling suggested had she ran, she would have won. She decided not to run. Then you had, Gallego versus Mary Rose Wilcox.
Mm-hmm.
Gallego eventually won, now U.S. Senator. I think it's, in such a short amount of time to have someone with current name ID who's been down there, history, it is a risk. It is a significant risk.
So, Chuck, if you are Adrian Fontes and his advisors, what do you need to see in polling, in focus groups to feel good and feel safe about leaving his current job to run for that?
Yeah. So let's talk about the electorate. So it's a very small, it's probably 20,000 votes. That's all, you know, that's who's
because of
vote.
The special election.
It's special election. It's a Democratic primary in a low turnout district. So it's sort of a very, you know, rifle shot at a particular constituency. So I agree with my colleague here that the sympathies will be with her, but she is, again, a county supervisor. You know, not there's no real narrative around that. Adrian's got a pretty big narrative that he brings to the table mm-hmm. about straightening out elections. He's from Nogales. That's a giant port of entry. He has a lot of economic credentials. He's a veteran. Dad's ranch was on the border. He's got a lot of stories to tell about his upbringing. He still owns property down there. And so I think but he's going to have a hard time. I think Daniel Hernandez is probably going to run as well.
Former state lawmaker.
Former state lawmaker, ran for Congress in the other district down there. He's going to be in the ring as well. So, you know, it's who can identify a constituency that I can turn out reliably. You would say you'd give a nose to that to Grijalva out of the sympathy vote that happens in a very quick election here. But, you know, she's going to have to raise money. She's going to have to organize herself. She's going to have to do that. Adrian will have to do that. Daniel will have to do that. Maybe Daniel and she sort of split up some of that very liberal base. Maybe there's a window there for Adrian to walk through.
In terms of name ID, I would think that Fontes certainly has it. But Adelita Grijalva, her last name ID is, I mean, that's pretty strong. Voters have been seeing that name on the ballot for two decades.
Yeah, I mean, that absolutely, right? Chuck was absolutely right when you talk about the base of the voters. I would say that the Democrats who are probably going to be voting in this, they're going to be probably more likely Democrats who tend to vote often in elections, which means that they're going to have had a voting history for Grijalva, which also means they're also going to probably know of Adrian Fontes as well. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting race. I mean, I also think if you're Fontes, you say, you know, I'll run in this race. If I lose, I'll run for Secretary of State again in 2026. I could
really
potentially see that happening.
Huh. That would probably depend on, assuming he does this, the dominoes of who Governor Hobbs appoints to replace him and whether that person chooses to run. That's a whole nother conversation. Chuck, let me ask you about, speaking of Governor Hobbs, she's going to have to name a new director of the Arizona National Guard, Adjutant General. The current one is stepping down. And it seems as though this is sort of taking on the national dialogue over quote-unquote wokeness in the military. How easy or difficult do you think it'll be for the governor to get her nominee through?
Well, historically, it comes from inside the ranks, right? It historically comes from somebody that's currently serving in mm-hmm. the National Guard. Muhlbeck was one of those people, the previous one. So it usually comes with a record of service. So, I don't know, last time I checked, I didn't see a lot of wokeness going on in our National Guard unit out here. So, you know, I think she can pretty much pick and choose from somebody who's a valued public servant, veteran of the Arizona National Guard that's capable of leading it.
So, Reginald, we've seen, obviously, and we've talked about it on the show several times, sort of the trouble, I guess, the governor's had in getting her agency nominees appointed and confirmed. Do you agree with Chuck that this one might be, if not lower profile, then maybe just a little easier, assuming that she picks somebody who's already a member of the National Guard?
I think this is going to be more profile than it should be, right? I mean, you know, right now, you know, you have rising domestic deployments, you know, border tensions, disaster response. You have all of these things that are currently at play. You know, you turn on the news, you see, you know, Secretary Hesef and, you know, Trump and all of these things that are happening. This is going to be something that I do think that the legislature is going to absolutely politicize. And I think the governor has to show, you know, what her vision is for just border military readiness. All of that's going to be wrapped up into one.
Hoffman's appointed a few. He's let a few pass the gates.
Jake Hoffman,
down there.
The chair of that
the
committee.
The chairman of the committee. You know, the DOC director was last year. That could have been politicized. He's currently appointed and serving. There's others that fit that same mold. So I think she knowing what we all know in the room right now, I think that would weigh heavily on who you're going to pick.
All right. So, Reginald, I want to ask you quickly before we go to break. We see now the three finalists to replace Senator Eva Birch and Mesa, who resigned. Anything stand out to you about the three names that are going to the County Board of Supervisors?
No, I mean, I think they're all you know, good folks. I mean, I think that they will both, you know, all three of them, I think they'd add, you know, a uniqueness to that Democratic caucus and to that body in general. I mean, I know they all have histories of working across the aisle. So, I mean, I think, you know, each one of the candidates brings something a little bit more unique. And I think, you know, at the end of the day that, you know, I don't think that they can go wrong.
Chuck, forgive me for asking a cynical political question here. For the County Board of Supervisors, they are majority Republican. This is a swing district. Are they thinking about putting a Democrat maybe in that office who is maybe more vulnerable come next election?
Wouldn't be a bad thought there, Mark. They gave him one, too. I mean, they gave him Mr. Winkle, who's got a history as a problem with a DUI, was on the Mesa City Council and then was removed from the Mesa City Council. So they gave him one that would abide that. Now, you know, I've also seen that appointment process. They generally defer to the Democrat on the board to have a larger say in that.
Even if it's not their district?
Even if it's not their district.
Okay.
They're very collegial about that historically. And so it'll be interesting to see, given the new dynamics down on the board, there's a lot of difference and changes that have gone on down there, how that process works out as well.
Interesting. All right. That is Chuck Coughlin, also joined by Reginald Boulding. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, former State House Minority Leader Reginald Boulding and Chuck Coughlin of High Ground. So, Reginald, I'm going to make you sort of pine for your days in the legislature here for a minute. Probably not. Speaking of these budget issues that are sort of leading to a lot of finger pointing and a lot of harsh rhetoric at the Capitol between Republican lawmakers and the governor, the legislature did approve supplemental funding for a congregate care program in the Division of Child Safety, but still a lot of rancor over the Department of Economic Security program for the developmentally disabled. What does this say about the process potentially coming up of finding a budget for next year?
You know, this is definitely a classic, you know, power play between, you know, the executive and the legislature. And obviously, right now, what you're seeing is positioning for 2026, right? You know, how do you create a narrative around governor mismanagement? And that's what I think the legislature is trying to do. And I think that it comes with a significant risk, though, right? You know, when you have vulnerable populations that, you know, need support, they need immediate attention, you know, will voters see it as, you know, governor mismanagement, or will they see it as the legislature playing politics? And that is a gamble that I think that, you know, is going to be one that we'll all have to wait and look to see.
Yeah, the interesting thing here is it's obviously a Democratic governor, Republican legislature. You go back at the history here. Ducey had a lot of supplementals, and they approved, without batting an eye, a number of supplementals.
Which is a point Governor Hobbs is making.
Which she has made. The counterpoint to that, which is valid as well, is she didn't do a good job of communicating early on that this was a problem coming their way. Matt Gress, who's the former budget chair for Ducey, is now in the legislature. So he knows that. And he's been critical of the way they've been communicating on these things. So it's a little bit of it's a lot of political bluster going on. But there is some legitimate gripes on both sides.
Is it in any way, Chuck, do you think a harbinger for, I mean, obviously, these are our supplemental funding requests and needs for the current fiscal year, which runs through June 30th. Does this tell us anything about the way in which the next budget for the fiscal year starting on July 1st is going to come together or hopefully come together?
Well, they'll do this supplemental. There's still some developmental disability money that's still hanging out there that they still have to deal with. As the governor's pointed out, they also have an overrun in the voucher program. So that's a nice shot across the bow. So, yeah, it's going to be a vitriolic engagement here. This just hasn't been great. I mean, it hasn't been great from the get-go in terms of how these have been orchestrated and communicated. And minority leadership, I think, has largely been not part of this conversation, unfortunately. And the governor's been front and center on it. You know, in my view, it would be advisable to let them take a bigger role in that and use them to deflect more. But that's not the way it's been going.
Is that, to Reginald's point earlier, is that a way to maybe, if they were to take your advice, to sort of take some of the heat off the governor going into her next election?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You play it more as a third-party negotiation. Don't allow yourself to be dragged into the room instantaneously. You know, elevate your minority leadership and say, hey, they're there. Go talk to them. And so that just hasn't happened.
Reginald, we saw Arizona's two U.S. senators, Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, host a town hall about cuts to Medicaid. This seems like we saw the Chamber of Commerce and other business groups this week come out saying cuts to Medicaid would be a problem for them. How big politically is this issue becoming, especially in a place like Arizona?
Well, Arizona has one of the largest Medicaid populations in the country. So when to have two, sitting U.S. senators hosting the town hall collectively together on this topic is pretty unique, I would say, right? And you can tell by the turnout, this is something that's top of mind for folks, here in Arizona. This is going to be an issue, and it's going to be one in which I think people throughout the state, they're going to tune in across party lines. You know, when you talk about people's health care, you talk about seniors, whether you're talking about, your grandmother, grandfather, or, your healthcare personally, it affects the entire family. So, what's happening in D.C. is going to have a profound impact here in Arizona.
40% of rural Arizona is on Medicaid. That's pretty red territory out there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of veterans that are on Medicaid. There's a lot of vulnerable populations that are on Medicaid. Arizona has a really good Medicaid program. Traditionally, through Access, the only one of the few managed care programs in the country, and beneficial in that respect, should be better for taxpayers. And so there's a lot to say here about what we do, how we do it, and the benefits we provide, and the health of our overall healthcare industry. I mean, Governor Brewer did the expansion at a point in time. The pandemic hits under Ducey. The healthcare industry is in great shape. Prior to that, the uncompensated care coming out of the recession was enormous. It was crushing hospitals, and then that has now gone away because people can be covered under Medicaid. And so, we have a healthy healthcare system that will be put at risk as a result of this.
Well, and Arizona also has that trigger law, right, Chuck?
Yep.
That if federal funding goes below a certain level, that expansion population is out.
Right. She negotiated. But the other thing people forget about Arizona is we have voted twice as a state to cover up to 100% of the federal poverty level. Obama took that to 139%, which included, tens of thousands of more people. But we, as a state, are financially responsible for covering this population up to 100% of FPL, regardless of what the feds do.
Right.
That is part of our legacy as a state. So it's not like the decks get cleared because they clear them in Washington. It becomes our obligation at 100% of FPL.
So, Reginald, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the things that I'm hearing a lot is, kids care, right?
Yeah.
Making sure that, children have the ability, to go see a doctor, get the medication that they need, people with disabilities, working families. These are, critical populations here in Arizona. And, you're really creating a universe of folks who now have something that that's relatable collectively. And they have a finger that they can point toward and say, hey, like when you're making these cuts, you're directly impacting me.
I want to ask both of you, because to something Chuck said about the population in rural parts of the state that relies on Medicaid and their political leanings, typically more conservative, more Trump territory out there. Where does the rubber hit the road on this? Where if people like, is that something losing your health care? Is that something that would get MAGA voters, Trump voters, Republican voters to maybe look at this administration a little differently, Reginald? What do you think?
You know, it's interesting, right? Because I think that, you know, and again, some of these areas where you have, you know, congressional members who are going to absolutely hear from their constituents that, hey, I need you to step up and fight back. I think that the congressional members could take some heat while at the same time that same voter may look at, you know, President Trump and what's happening with Trump and Musk differently. I think that, you know, the view of, you know, my congressional member is not fighting for me, but Trump is actually the one fighting for me, when it's actually, you know, the congressional member's, you know, authority influence is not as much as it is with the president. It's going to be interesting to see.
Well, Senator Kelly said it well. I think it was in your lead up bite there. He goes, this is all a mask for a tax cut, for a trillion, you know, a huge tax cut for the wealthy. That's going to be the hue and cry here. Is if they go after that program and then try to pass the tax cut, they're going to be like looking askance at that. That's a good leverage point for Democrats to play. But then I, you know, back to your question, do you look at, you know, what other alternative is out there? And, you know, I've said this many times, the Democratic cupboard of ideas is pretty bare as to what they're offering versus, you know, just Trump's failure. I mean, we're familiar with Trump and Musk's overstepping, but what's your plan? What is your idea? And that's not really well articulated now. And so it'll be interesting to see, like in the congressional race down south, how is that narrative about what the Democratic Party is going to do develop?
Well, that's an interesting one, because that is such a strong, we were talking about the Grijalva seat.
Yeah.
That is such a strong Democratic district that probably anti-Trump would be enough to win that one, right?
But in those two, if you got Hernandez and her like breaking up the left base, is there an alley there to develop? And I think Democrats are hungry for leadership, you know, not just, oh, let's go pummel them. Let's go point the finger at their fault. Well, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? So I think there's a giant alleyway here, which I think everybody should pay close attention to in some of these Democratic races, is who's talking about that? Who's talking about creating, you know, Schumer just took it on the chin last week, which I thought was the righteous thing to do, because it's never a good idea to shut down the government. You get blamed. I mean, Mitch McConnell knew that, Boehner knew that, Ryan knew that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a dumb idea. And he got pummeled by the activist left because he led.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that the activists less. I think people are saying, look, you know, right now that there is an economic crisis that is here and it's looming and it will grow, right? And you can't balance budgets on the backs of working class families, children, folks with disabilities, whether we're in D.C. or here back at home in Arizona. I do think that, you know, sort of this populism idea and in conversations that's going to be happening will give folks sort of the edge. I mean, right now, you know, Democrats, you know, they're talking about, you know, taxes and whether or not, you know, you have corporations who are receiving, you know, multiple, you know, tax breaks. But I'm not sure that's just what the public wants to hear specifically.
Back to that race down south. Is the border an economic asset? It is. And so, you know, being critical of the administration and not resolving the immigration and the trade issue and punishing Mexico with tariffs is a terrible idea
absolutely.
For growing. I mean, there's this narrative around Democrats, the abundance narrative, which likes apologizing. It sounds like you're apologizing for making money. But, you know, is there a way to grow the economy in juxtaposition to this craziness that Trump's doing?
Interesting. All right, I'll have to leave it there. Chuck Coughlin, Reginald Boulding, thanks you both for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, an art gallery's 48th year exhibition is gathering community around aesthetic and philosophical experimentation. But first, there is a new trend in travel and tourism, and some Arizona locations are set to try to take advantage of it. Knock tourism is on the rise, meaning travelers are staying up late and doing more things at night. And places like observatories and other space-related destinations across the state could see more visitors. Jennifer Broom is a freelance travel and environmental journalist and meteorologist. She recently wrote a piece in Condé Nast Traveler about Tucson's new astrotourism trail. I spoke with her more about this trend, and we started by defining what exactly Noctourism refers to.
Yeah, so you're hearing this term called knock tourism, or it's also called astrotourism or night tourism. It is basically anything that happens after the sun goes down. You know, I think you hear a lot about like national parks, you know, the tagline that they use, half the park is after dark, you know, with that trend in people being so excited to experience the night sky, learn more about it. And then, of course, the craze that we've seen with the solar eclipses, the chasing the northern lights, you know, all of that falls under nocturism. It also includes things like resorts and different destinations that kind of focus in on that night tourism.
What is behind this increase in interest in doing things at night when you're traveling?
You know, I think it's a lot of things. I think we're all craving something that unifies us a little bit. The reality is we all live under the stars. We live under the sun. It's something we all can share. It's kind of like weather. We all share weather. Everybody likes to talk about it as well. and it's just, honestly, it's that good old fashioned fun. It's free. In a lot of cases, if you just want to go, you know, somewhere away from city lights and just gaze at the night sky, maybe try to see the International Space Station making a pass, or look for the shooting stars, or just observe anything in the night sky, try to look for the planets as well. That's free to do. You know, and it is something that's, I think we all are craving education too. And it's the final frontier, you know, there's so much buzz about it. I love it.
Is there an element to this too that, you know, especially for example, here in Phoenix during the summer, there are more of things, more events happening at night just because it's so hot and unpleasant to be outside when the sun is out during the day. I wonder if there's an element of that as well. People who maybe want to travel to Phoenix or other places that are really hot during the day during the summer, but at night it's a little more tolerable to be out.
Yeah, I think it really is. And, you know, you're kind of touching on a little bit, you know, bringing in the climate change aspect of it, of, you know, we are seeing hotter days. We're also seeing, you know, more violent storms. We're seeing when it gets cold, more extreme cold. So part of climate change is that, as the meteorologist in me, you know, is recognizing that we have extremes, and that's the extreme cold and the extreme heat. So I think you are starting to see places, say, you know, that do, like Phoenix, that are skewing on, you know, the hotter side of the scale, looking for the opportunities to still get outside. How can you still do some things and still enjoy? And, you know, not just in Phoenix, but I mean, throughout Arizona, there's so much desert landscape that truly does come alive as the sun goes down. And yes, those cooler temperatures at night really, truly do help.
How are destinations adapting to this new trend? I mean, how are they maybe marketing things you can do at night and maybe adjusting what they provide during the day for, you know, for people who maybe are planning to be out at night as opposed to, you know, back in their hotel or, you know, sort of just wandering around?
Yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting trend, you know, that we're seeing with destinations really going hard on spotlighting what you can do at night. And that's going beyond, oh, just go downtown and enjoy the restaurants and bars. Mm-hmm. It's really about what are ways that we can experience the outdoors. I recently wrote an article for Condé Nast Traveler on Tucson, mm-hmm. Being the first in the world to do this Astro Trail. And they got together and decided, okay, we have all of these world-renowned observatories and things that are related to the night sky. So I think as places, you're getting more and more places that are really focusing in, and Tucson was a leader in this. Back in the 70s, they really started saying, we're going to do some things to combat light pollution. Because obviously, if you want to look at the night sky and enjoy all the wonders of galaxies far, far away, you need dark skies. You need to be away from city lights.
Yeah. So in the world of travel, how big is nocturism? Like, how big of a deal is it sort of in the world of travel?
It is becoming increasingly popular. I think like some of these things have kind of been around and there wasn't a buzzword name to it. But as you're seeing more and more parks get involved and more, you know, places like Phoenix and Tucson and that do have really, really hot summers that are starting to look at what are some alternatives? How can we still get people to come and visit and enjoy the spectacular outdoor areas and spaces that are around, but do it safely. But I think it's really just, you know, really within the past year, starting to see this trend bubbling up of, and kind of getting that phrase of the nocturism or, you know, astrotourism, you know, or just night tourism. It's a travel concept, I guess, that's still in its infancy and still finding its way, but increasingly popular. And I just love it. There's so much excitement, you know, about the things coming up.
Do you get the sense that this trend is sustainable?
100%. Absolutely. You know, the night sky's not going anywhere.
True.
You know, I mean, it's going to be there. So I think people are so curious about things. And, you know, there's so much, you know, the race to space really is still fascinating to all of us. You know, it doesn't matter what age you are, just looking up and seeing the spectacular night sky fills so much, especially when you get out of the city lights. You know, when you live in the city and you have that opportunity to get out and just go somewhere. And, you know, even if you just sit on the side of the road and look up and stare at the night sky and look and see what's there, it really does pique our curiosity and fascination of what's out there, you know, and like I said, it's just pure old fashioned enjoyment, and it gets you off your phone, off the computer, and in whether you do it by yourself as a solo traveler or do it with family and friends, it's an opportunity to at least connect with something, whether that's connecting with the people you're with or simply connecting with yourself and the beauty of the night sky.
All right. That is Jennifer Broom, a freelance travel and environmental journalist, among many other things. Jennifer, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Today is day two of the NCAA men's basketball tournament and day one of the women's tournament, and three Arizona teams will be taking the court. On the men's side, the fourth-seeded University of Arizona Wildcats take on 13-seeded Akron in Seattle this afternoon, while the 13th-seeded Grand Canyon University Antelopes play fourth-seeded Maryland, also in Seattle. The GCU women are also a 13 seed and will play 4-seed Baylor in Waco shortly after noon today. With me now to break down their chances is Brad Sesmat, CEO of Sports360AZ.com. Hey, Brad.
Mark, here we go. Another year of March Madness.
Another year of March
Madness.
Within
our state.
So let's start with U of A. This, of course, their first season in the Big 12. They are a 4th seed. This has sort of been an up and down season for them, right?
It really has been. I think if you look at today's matchup with how the Cats have played, not just this season under Tommy Lloyd, they've had some very impressive victories, but at times they haven't been able to shoot the ball very straight from three-point country. They meet an Akron team today. The Wildcats defensively are not very good. Akron has hit 15 or more threes 7 times already this season. Dropping knowledge on you, Mark,
yeah,
about this. And I think if you look at what could be one of those upsets, if you're a diehard U of A basketball fan in March Madness, guess what? You've died hard through the years because they have this penchant for everybody getting excited, bear down and all that. And all of a sudden, all the air comes out of the balloon. It's the lead balloon at a party. So can the Zips, what a great nickname, by the way, Akron,
yeah,
Zips.
That's a good one.
Can they hold U of A inside? That's the key to the game. U of A has a lot of size. Akron doesn't have one player over 6'7".
Oh, wow.
A lot of times they'll play kids that are 6'3", 6'4". Very small lineup, Mark.
All right. So speaking of 13 seeds, the GCU Antelopes, the men's team, won their conference tournament last week. Now they get a date with a 4th-seeded Maryland. GCU has been a strong team the last couple of years, and it seems as though maybe their strongest player is kind of rounding into form as they head into the tournament.
Yeah, Tyson Grant Foster is a terrific player. He's had some injuries this season. I feel like there's a missing element to this year's GCU team. When I've watched them play in person, the leadership their senior from last year, Gabe McLaughlin, provided, I haven't seen that glue guy step forward this season. It's a different game now, Mark. You've got players that are looking at what is being put into their checking accounts rather than what their shooting percentage is. And I'm not saying that directly to GCU. It's just, yeah, you got some guys that really like playing the game, and then you have some guys that really want to get paid to play the game. And so I feel like Bryce Drew's done a heck of a job coaching this season. Maryland, though, man, tall task, literally. The Terps have big inside presence. I think for GCU today, it's all about, can they spread the ball around the floor and try to not be that team that goes inside? Because it just looks like the Terrapins are far too big on the inside for them.
So maybe three-point shooting, a big key for the Antelope men today?
Yeah. I think the Lopes, if they can get out and run, it's one of those games where, as we've seen Bryce Drew through the years, you know, Jerry Colangelo will be in the stands, of course, big GCU supporter, mm-hmm. and President Mueller, and the way that GCU has built this program, it's phenomenal to think that Grand Canyon was just sitting there about ready to be closed back in the early 2000s, and here they are now in the NCAA tournament, almost a afterthought of every season. GCU is going to make it into March Madness.
All right, so Brad, we got to talk about the GCU women, who are a 13 seed playing the 4th seed Baylor. But my goodness, they're on a 30-game win streak?
Mark, that's a great story. And remember, next year the Final Four is here for the women.
That's right.
In Glendale. And so you look at the job that their head coach Molly Miller has done. Her name is attached to the Arizona State job that's open. Her name's also attached to the Arkansas job that's open. Molly Miller has done a tremendous job of building her program, and she has 8 seniors, okay? So you have a veteran team. You have a team that really enjoys the game. When you watch them play, they have a joy and a spirit about them that you want March Madness to be all about. Add to that the Havocs, the fans, the student section, all that. It's just a phenomenal story, and they play the game the right way. This is not a three-point shooting team from start to finish. A lot of the games you see now, it's three-point shot. This is a real basketball team. They play the game the right way. So a couple storylines there. You know, they're going to go to Baylor. That's tough.
Yeah.
Very tough. One. Two, is this Molly Miller's last run at GCU? Because from every indication, Arizona State is all over her trying to get her to GCU.
Interesting. All right. So, Brad, just about 40 seconds left. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Of these three teams, which one, if any of them, do you think comes away with a win today?
Oh, wow. Who I want to? I it's going to take care of the Zips today. You know, the Zips, that nickname started in the 1920s. Well, the Zips, of all people. They shoot straight. Akron could give them a game, but I think U of A is going to come through today.
All right. Very good. That is Brad Sesmat, CEO of Sports360AZ.com. Brad, always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Mark, anytime. Stay well.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. There's one name in the Phoenix art scene that pretty much everyone knows, and it's not the most famous artist in town. It's Lisa Setti, owner of the Lisa Setti Gallery. You know you've arrived as an artist when your work lands there. It's a rarefied group, including luminaries and statement makers like Mame Kratz, Angela Ellsworth, and Mark Klett. Her first gallery was in Tempe, and for many years she's been in an Al Beadle design building in Central Phoenix. But she first really made her mark on the art world here as a pioneer of the Scottsdale gallery scene. Though it's known for its cowboy oil paintings and desert landscapes, that's not the kind of work that gets Setti excited. She champions artists who have something to say, whether it be political or whether it be William Wegman, famous for his artistic portraits of his own Weimaraner dogs. And this year, she's celebrating her gallery's 40th anniversary, an incredible legacy in an ever-changing valley and an ever-underestimated art scene. My co-host Lauren Gilger stopped by to get a peek at the 40th anniversary show she recently launched and spoke with her more about her legacy and her approach to art. Setti came to Arizona as an ASU student in 1978 because she was interested in learning from a particular professor, a British photo historian named Bill Jay. At the time, she told Lauren, she thought she was going to be an artist herself.
And then as soon as I graduated, I realized that I was more interested in what other people had to say than what I had to say because of a fairly traditional, normal upbringing, and I just didn't think I was that interesting. So I was living in a house with 6 roommates, so 7 of us total. It was an old house that belonged to the first Tempe printer, I think. And we had no furniture, so there was, you know, nothing in the living room. And I thought, well, this is such a nice empty space with all this wall space. I should have an exhibition of my fellow artists. And so that must have been probably 1978 or 1979. Maybe that was my first gallery or idea of a gallery. But I knew as soon as I graduated that I didn't really want to be an artist, but I needed to be close to art and in the arts.
Okay, so you have your first quote-unquote gallery show in your house, right? What did that feel like? Do you remember sort of getting a thrill out of being the curator, being the person to put this together?
That's a great question, great way to look at it. Of course, I didn't realize what I was doing at the time, but I must have loved it because I think I remember I liked organizing it. I liked the outcome. I mean, there weren't any sales or anything, but I liked how things looked. And I liked that I was, you know, trying to elevate other people's work.
So you begin there and then you take it into, the most successful gallery career in Phoenix, right? Like, how did you kind of make the leap from, you know, a house show into opening your own gallery?
Well, I started as soon as I graduated working with my ex-husband, Joe Segura, and we opened a print publishing company. And then that sort of easily sort of morphed into a gallery space for me in a little part of the front part of the shop. And I realized that prints, you know, fine art prints really weren't, that wasn't my thing. And I wanted to show, you know, originals. So that was probably back in 1981. I've been an employer since 1981. I was in my like early 20s as an employer, which is really silly.
But there must have been, I wonder about this because so much of what you do, right, is relationships with artists. And then relationships with buyers. So it's a lot about people. How did you start to shape your language and your thinking about not just talking to people who might want to buy a piece of art, but talking to artists about how they sell it?
I like people and I like connecting people. And I like that artists think in a way that most people don't. And that there are many people who are responsive to that type of thought. And so I think my joy was in putting them together. Mm-hmm.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions about sense of place, right? Like what you do is located here, right, physically. But I also know that you've worked with artists over the years that are from here. You brought up artists from here. And you've worked with a lot of artists that kind of deal with that idea, like whether it's an immigration kind of sensibility or if it's somebody who wants to talk about the environment, sustainability, these sorts of issues that really ring true in Arizona. How do you view the artists you choose, the people you work with, and the place that you're in?
I'm going to go back to the show we had before this one, which took place October, and it was timed for the election. And it was called Grand Canyon From Dreams to Memory. And we decided to focus on immigration because I thought that was an important issue as it related to the election, impending election. And we chose seven artists from six different countries. And I wanted their perspective on something that I personally sort of took for granted, the Grand Canyon. I mean, I had the privilege of being born in the United States. I went to the canyon once. I looked over. It was magnificent. And I came home and didn't really think that much about it again. And so that brought in artists from many different countries, but some of whom are here in Arizona, too. The West has always attracted artists for many different reasons, the light, the landscape. And so we do work with a pretty great group of, you know, artists that happen to be based in Arizona.
I mean, I wonder that because so much of what you think of when you think of the art scene, and especially in Old Town Scottsdale there, is Western art, right? Which is not what you do. I wonder about the kind of going with trends or understanding where the headwinds are taking you and then sort of saying, no, I'm going to show this instead because this is the artist I think is good.
Well, we don't follow trends. We never have because I'm just not that hip. And I'm kind of in my own little world. And so I'm focusing on what interests me at the time. And maybe that has to do with what's happening in the world politically, you know, socially. But I'll also say that my idea of a Western artist is probably different than other people's idea of a Western artist. Like my idea of a Western artist could be James Turrell, who's working with, you know, the extinct volcano, the crater up in northern Arizona. Or for instance, Mark Klett, who's in our, both of whom are in our anniversary show. And, you know, Mark's looking at it from a geological perspective and time, you know, time in the West maybe moves a little slower. You know, so I feel like we do show some Western artists, but they're not, it's not a traditional Western art that most people, you know, might think of.
I want to ask you about the I guess for lack of a better phrase, the art scene in Arizona, in Phoenix, in the Valley, because you've been a part of it for so long and an important part of it for so long. How do you view us in the national or international art world? Do people still think you're crazy to try to sell fine art in Arizona?
Yes.
As simple as that.
Yes. I mean, there's a big art scene here, but again, it's, I don't want to say stigmatized, but it's sort of put into a niche of, maybe it's the advertising that's done around a lot of the art, and especially in Scottsdale, and it's more traditional, and it seems like they're not really up to date with what's really happening here in the art scene. And we don't have a lot of art criticism here that then reaches to a broader audience, you know, outside of the state. So that makes it difficult to break the stereotype.
Let me ask you about the idea of abstract versus, you know, something that's more realistic or has a purpose in a more obvious way, I guess. I wonder this about art, because so much of art is subjective, right? And your job is to be sort of objective about this subjective thing and say, this is what is good. You're the arbiter of that, right? How do you know? How do you, like, do you ever think you've had misses?
Sure, I've probably had lots of misses. I mean, I guess the way that I would describe it is that I'm looking for an artist whose their reason for creating it is sincere, and they're compelled to make it. They have to make it. They have to get a message out. And the message is often personal, but then that personal message opens up to being something universal. And I'm also looking, like, to see, is the medium that you're working in, does it make sense for what your message is, you know, for what you're trying to get across? I'm looking for something that I've never seen anything like this before. I need a new medium or a new message that where they coalesce and they teach me something in a way that, you know, that I just respond to at a gut level. So the gut level probably comes first, and then all the intellectual stuff happens after that. But I'm interested in people's stories. Like, what compelled you to make this work? What was so important about your background or your experience that you had to create something for yourself, but then also to be brave enough to take out into the world?
Yeah. Is that how you view your role, as the person, kind of the behind-the-scenes person who's finding and choosing and displaying this work?
I think maybe I was born in the 1860s or something, like, you know, as an explorer and, you know, and to tread lightly on, you know, new land, but to discover things.
Lisa Setti, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Lauren. It was so nice to meet you and talk with you. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.